Life is better together. Now, notice I didn't say it's easier. Life together can certainly be easier in many ways, and we'll consider that in the passage this morning. And life together can be challenging and messy, but life together is better. Life is meant to be shared. This is another one of those structures that God has put in creating the world. But before I get ahead of myself and jump into our passage, which is in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, let me give a quick recap of what we have considered together so far in this book. It's a new series. We've only had 3 sermons in. It's 14 sermons long. So because we've had a break the last couple of weeks from the sermon series, I want to give a quick recap to consider together what we have considered so far. I want to make sure that there are some things that we remember together because it'll help us to understand the passage today. God is God. We are not. God is creator. We are creature. And oh, the ways that we fight against these two simple and foundational truths. This fight against the ways of God and this fight against our limitations is a major theme that the teacher highlights in this letter, in this writing. Now, this is your first Sunday. The way that we're referring to the author of Ecclesiastes is as the teacher, or maybe the preacher, but we're calling him the teacher based on what we see in the scripture here. That's how he refers to himself. That's how we will refer to him. In God's creation of everyone and everything, he has set rhythms and boundaries and limitations. And the teacher has brought us along in his journey under the sun as he wrestles with these limitations. He's welcomed us into his life to where he asks hard questions and where he points to uncomfortable truths. These are truths and questions that most of us have thought about at one time or another, but we distract ourselves from them because they're just too heavy to think about. We don't really want to think about what's going to happen in the last days of our life. What happens after that? What is the purpose of all these things? Sometimes you just say, well, I'd rather just not think about those things. And so he has pushed the limits with these questions and is kind of forcing us to consider things that are important to consider. Not only has he pushed the limits of the questions he asks, but he's pushed the limits of this world and of life in ways that most of us can't. You see, we still have these disillusions that there might be something in this world that can satisfy us deeply because there's so much that we don't have. Right? We haven't reached a level in this world where we have such wealth that we can buy whatever we want without hesitation. We haven't experienced certain pleasures that look like they could satisfy. We haven't experienced them, so maybe they will satisfy us, but the teacher has. He has had wealth and power and position that most humans can never even come close to achieving. We can think in our time today, think of Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, this wealth where they can buy everything, do whatever they want without a thought, right? That's who the teacher is. That's from the position that he's speaking of. And so he brings us along with him so that we would learn from his life rather than despair on our own. Now, through his observations of nature and humanity, which we saw in chapter 1, and through his own experiences of seeking pleasure and pursuing wisdom, which we saw in chapters 2 and 3, in considering the reality of death that comes to every one of us, he has come to a conclusion that there is no gain under the sun. Now, remember with me what he means by gain. Gain speaks to what's left over at the end, that which remains, right? That which we don't lose, that we can hold on to. And he says that there's no real advance because everything eventually ends. and we can keep nothing afterwards. So his conclusion, if you will, not the final conclusion, but one of the things he reaches, is that if there is nothing that lasts, then there is nothing that matters. That's his conclusion. And that's the key word of this book, futility, vanity, meaningless, or even absurdity. That as he observes all these things, he's just like, this is just crazy. This is literally absurd, is what he is saying. One point that I need to keep bringing up is that the teacher isn't cynical. He's not a fatalist, right? He hasn't given up on everything and on everyone. No, he may seem that way, but he has deep hope and deep purpose for us. He knows what it's like to hope in something that doesn't satisfy. And so he's destroying those things so that he can lead us towards true satisfaction. He's popping all of those hopes and dreams that we have so that we don't waste our own time and our own lives chasing after them. This chase for satisfaction in this world is like chasing the wind. And so he asks the questions that we don't really like to think about. And he pushes them until we are confronted with the reality of them. Not to leave us in a state of brokenness or despair. No, that's not his purpose. He destroys so that he can build. Eric Ortlund says it this way. In order to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that does. And that's a good description of what the teacher wants for us. Now, as we've been working through the book of Ecclesiastes, again, we're still in kind of the first quarter of the book. At the end of chapter 3, we caught our first glimpse of light, a glimpse of grace and of hope. In seeking and observing and experience, he fell into despair. And it was there in his despair that he found the gateway to light. Sorry, the gateway to delight and to joy. It was there that we got our first lesson about how it is that we can live life under the sun. He understood that life is gift, not gain. It's not about trying to take and take and keep and keep. Life isn't about trying to squeeze out of this world the things that it was never meant to give. No, life as gift tells us that the way to live in this world is to live in this world. Right? Don't try to take things out of this world. Don't try to make it give you what it was never able to give. Right? The world, to use his phrasing, the eating and the drinking and the being merry, that's not all there is, and so we despair. It's what there is. It's what has been given. And so he's saying, don't miss it, trying to make it more than it is. Enjoy life as a gift that has been given by God, and gifts are to be received. If we are able to see our lives, everything we have and everything we don't have, as gifts from God, then we can enjoy life for what it is. You see, when we try to make good things ultimate things, then we can't enjoy them for what they are. They feel empty. They feel less because they're not fulfilling us in the ways that we hoped they would. But if we're able to see a good thing for what it is, our work, our school, our hobbies, knefe, we can have joy in them and appreciate them for what they are. Not asking, if you remember from a previous sermon, our knefe to do what knefe can't do. I can delight in these good gifts of God, but when I want them to be everything, they're then not only not good, but they're not enough. They lead us into despair. You see, when we can see these good things for what they are, we can have joy in them. We can enjoy the moments of this life as gifts for the short time that we have life under the sun. Now, as we continue in our series through the book of Ecclesiastes, when we come to chapter 4, we see that chapter 4 adds another layer to this, another important aspect about how to live life under the sun, right? How to find purpose under the sun, to live with meaning. If our first key or glimpse of light or hope, whatever, I don't exactly know what to call it, if our first observation and real lesson to live life well under the sun is life is gift, not gain, right? That's our first key. Then our second key, as we'll see here, life is to be shared. Life is to be shared. This life can be empty if we expect more from it than it can give, and also empty when it's centered on ourselves and lived alone. And so that's what we'll see in chapter 4. Our text is going to say a few different things, and at times it's going to feel a bit disjointed. We might not be able to see how it all connects right away. But one of the ways that it's connected is with this theme of relationships. If we look at our 12 verses, chapter 4, verse 4 through 16, those 12 verses can be broken up into four small groupings, highlighting relationships. And so that's how we're going to work through our passage this morning. Look with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 4. The teacher writes, "I saw that all labor and all skillful work is due to one person's jealousy of another. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind." What's he saying? He's saying labor and skillful work, those are good things in and of themselves. But the teacher points out that they're easily corrupted because of the way of the world and because of the sin in our heart. Right, the joy of skillful work, I picture artistry or wood carving, the ability to create things as we reflect the Creator who created all things. Right, honest work, hard work, work that we have to train for, this is good. And also what it can provide is good. Now, it can't be an end in and of itself. It's never enough on its own. But it's any good is taken away because it's tainted by our jealousy of another. I want to be better than them. I want to make more than them. I want to go farther than them. Now this comparison, this first of four relationships that we see, is such a poison to our lives. And it's a poison to our relationships. And so relationally, we see the negative way that we can interact with those in our lives. We can be centered on ourselves all while hating our neighbor for what they have. The striving never ends, does it? And we're always trying to reach the next accomplishment. And then you finally reach the person that you're jealous of, only to walk through a door and say, oh, there's next, the next person, the next victim, the next person. And even as I surpass them, there's more and more. Our eyes are never satisfied. The teacher rightly points out how absurd it is to live in this way. It's just as crazy as chasing the wind. Verse 5 goes on to give us the opposite extreme of overwork, laziness. Look with me to verse 5. "The fool folds his arms and consumes his own flesh." Delightful imagery there, right? We are a people, as we consider, who so quickly jump from one extreme to another. Right? We tell ourselves, okay, well, if working so hard never reaches anywhere, then I'll never work again. Fold my hands. You can't make me do anything, right? Not willing to work. And then what happens? They end up destroying themselves. That's the imagery of consuming themselves. They waste away because all there is themselves. Now, just like the extreme of overworking is grounded in jealousy and self-centeredness, and how we'll see it stated in verse 6, two handfuls with much effort. The other extreme of laziness is also self-centered and also an act of hating your neighbor. No, not working means you have nothing to share, nothing to give. When we're not centering life on our wants and our needs and our jealousies, and we begin to consider that our life is to be shared, what happens, as I shared with the kids, I think you were listening in, right? We are then freed from the tyranny of self, of needing more and never being satisfied and just eventually consuming ourselves with either extreme. Friends, seeing our life as one to be shared helps us to shift our focus from ourselves, and it, of course, benefits our neighbor, but also in turn, we are blessed and given benefit. Right? When we give away and share what we wrongly thought we could keep for personal gain, friends, we're not losing, we're gaining. But when we give, we have neighbors to enjoy life with. Look to verse 6 and see how the teacher describes it. Better one handful with rest than two handfuls with effort and a pursuit of the wind. So in verse 5, we see the extreme of laziness. And the second half of verse 6 is an image of overwork, right? Having two hands with effort, taking everything we can, two handfuls, effort for nothing, as he points out. And yet in between the two extremes, we find the balanced and blessed approach. Better is one handful with rest. Kids, I wonder, I was thinking of you as I'm preparing the sermon, I wonder if you have ever seen a picture or a video of a chipmunk with their cheeks filled with seeds and nuts, and you know, just it's incredible how big their cheeks can get. I saw a video this week. I won't tell you how many chipmunk videos I watched, but there's more than one and less than 100. So that's the grouping that I'm going to confess this morning. Much less than 100, but certainly more than one. I saw a video of a chipmunk whose mouth was so full, every time he tried to open the mouth, the seeds just fell out like a dam broken, just water, right? Just so much in their mouth. Now, what happens in that? They've taken so much that they can't enjoy. They can't even eat the food that's in their mouth. Right? I don't know if they can even fit into the hole in the tree because their cheeks are too big. And so all the things that they think they're able to do, they're not benefiting from. And so I was thinking of that chipmunk as I was thinking of you and I was thinking of the sermon. The chipmunk would benefit from the wisdom that the teacher is giving here, right? One cheekful is enough. One handful is enough. Think with me, adults, you can listen in now. Having enough with rest and peace and time to enjoy what you have is far superior than spending so much effort and time to get more than you need and then end up being too exhausted to enjoy it or willing to share it. It seems simple, and it's true. The teacher's wisdom is humble, especially here in chapter 4. But please don't dismiss this wisdom because of its simplicity. Living life in the extremes is such a default for so many of us. So many of us have this, it's all or nothing sort of attitude. It's me or no one. And the teacher, in my paraphrase, is saying, chill, relax. Thank you, Ahmed, for, wasn't meant to be a joke, but that's literally what he's communicating. Just stop striving so much for the things you know don't satisfy. Relax, right? There is a better way, and it's much simpler than you think. And it brings more joy and peace than you think it will. Now, he's not saying it directly here, but you're going to see how the imagery develops in just a bit. But the imagery later on makes me think that having only one handful instead of the two, right? Only having one handful means that you have a free hand to extend to someone who might need help. Having only one handful means that you have a hand available to hold someone's hand and enjoy this life with others. Look with me to verses 7 and 8. Again, I saw futility under the sun. There is a person without a companion, without even a son or brother. And though there is no end to all his struggles, his eyes are still not content with riches. Who am I struggling for, he asks, and depriving myself of good things? This too is futile and a miserable task. And so the teacher goes back to this idea of endless striving that never satisfies. This working and working with no end to our struggles, as he wrote. Working and still our eyes aren't content with riches. It speaks of two things relationally that I want to think on with you. First, we see that this kind of ceaseless striving makes us miss out on establishing relationships. This ceaseless striving makes us miss out on establishing relationships. Think with me of a man or a woman who has prioritized their career over everything else. They pursue it in such a way that they never in their lives engage in meaningful relationships. Now, some may desire marriage and children, but they keep waiting to get to the next level because they believe that once they get there, then they'll be able to start their lives. And yet, once they get to that next level, there's something else, and it keeps going and going, and they never start their lives. The teacher is saying this isn't a way to live. This is not the life that we have been given. Because as we've considered and will continue to consider, we can't keep any of the things we earn here. There is no gain under the sun, and we are all living under the sun. And this kind of living is futility, where we keep hearing this word that's used nearly 40 times in 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes, right? It's absurd. There are good things that we can enjoy, right? Gifts from God, but we forsake them and end up losing everything. And so not only does ceaseless striving miss out on making and establishing relationships, the second thing I want to point out is that they make us miss out on established relationships. Ceaseless striving for things under the sun to gain the two handfuls, if you will, could make us miss out on established relationships. Now, there are some who work and work because there's no other option. The brokenness of the world and the corruption of certain countries. There's someone who can work three times as many hours as they sleep, and they still don't have enough to live. And so this point by the teacher isn't speaking about those who are striving and having to overwork just to maintain a standard basic living for a human, right? He's not speaking to those people. He's speaking to those who don't need that second handful, but they want it more than anything else. And so he's asking, he's confronting us with, at what cost? You see, if you're striving after that second handful, know that there is always a cost. There is always a sacrifice, whether we see it or not. And so I ask, is it your friendships? Is it your health? Is it your marriage? What about your children? I think the first thing I ever heard from Pastor Tim Keller, who's now with our Lord in glory, I think one of the first things ever, a sermon that he preached, watched on a video, long before I ever knew anything about Tim Keller and church planting and gospel centrality and all the wonderful things that I and many of us have benefited from Tim. I remember he said, we think child sacrifices are a thing of the past, but they still happen today. Now, we think sacrificing children of idols and altars, and we take our kids and we do these things, really scary things that have happened in kind of vile cultures and things that are unholy. He said, but so many of us still sacrifice our children for what's next, for what we want, and then our children grow up, and we've missed their childhood. They have missed their parents. And so he's saying there is a cost. It's simple wisdom, but it's profound. What he's saying is not only don't forget the cost and the sacrifice, but why not enjoy today in real ways? Why can't you stop and share a real experience with a loved one, a companion, a friend, a son, or whoever it might be, a neighbor? Why don't you just keep that one handful and rest? Isn't that why you're striving? All this striving is for rest. So he's saying, why can't you just rest with one? The questions keep coming back to, what's the point? And in this response, even though there's the looming shadow of no gain under the sun, what he's basically saying is that it's better at least to have a companion, a son, a brother or sister in this life. We're going to see that phrase repeat a lot in chapter 4, this idea of better, right? Better one handful. Next, we'll see better two than one. Or later towards the end, better to be poor and wise than rich and foolish, right? And so here, even though he's not using that same repeated phrase of better, we can almost hear him say, in the struggles and the striving, better at least if we can share our life. Simple but true words, a humble wisdom for us to consider together. I appreciate how David Gibson says it also. He writes, the value of life is not what you earn, but who you relate to. It's not what you buy, but what you give. I love that. Let's keep reading. Look with me to verses 9 and 12. And it's here that we're going to see most clearly what I said in my opening words to my favorite people in the church, right? Life is better together. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their efforts. For if either falls, his companion can lift him up. But pity the one who falls without another to lift him up. Also, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one person alone keep warm? And if someone overpowers one person, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. So in this third grouping of relationships, we find several different examples of why two or more is better than one. Right, the first two images in verses 9 and 10 keeps with this theme of wealth and gaining or striving. Right, so basically here saying, as an example, having a partner in business will bring greater reward for the amount of effort that's put in, right? Because there's two who are doing the work. And the image of falling is primarily related to financial hardship, right? It's related to money. So if either one of the two fall into hard times, then there is someone who can help you out of that difficulty. But I don't think that imagery needs to stay there alone, right? Any image of falling is helpful to understand the point and the blessing of relationships. If you fall down and are stuck in a pit, two are better than one because one can extend a hand to lift you up. Now compare that to not having anyone. It's no good. It's not the way it was meant to be. Two can stay warm, whereas one stays cold. Two can fight off an enemy, but if you're alone, you'll struggle to resist the attack. Simple wisdom, but it's important for us. It makes an important point. We need each other. I don't know how to tell you how much we need each other, especially in this world. How much we need community. How much I need you and how much you need me and all of us. Right? There's the verse that many of us know in Genesis that says it's not good for a man to be alone. And that is a true observation. And I love Sam Albury's comments about it. He points out that marriage is not the only answer to that observation. Right? It's not good for anyone to be alone because we have all been created for relationship, for family, for friendship. And so if you're here this morning and you're single, I thought about writing here, raise your hand and then we'll, you know, have coffee afterwards. But that's not where my notes are going, so I'm not either. But that slipped out, forgive me. But if you're here this morning and you're single, please listen. Christianity doesn't teach that you're alone until you get married. And if you don't get married, well, at least you have Jesus, but you'll always be alone, right? That's not the teaching of Christianity. That's absurd. The many verses that teach about needing one another isn't just fulfilled in marriage. Of course, marriage is a beautiful gift, and it displays much about the gospel and the love of God. But community and relationship isn't only fulfilled in marriage. They're fulfilled in the church. But I am getting ahead of myself here, so we'll get back to that point in just a bit. Notice with me the phrasing in verse 12. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. And so it's building on this strength of relationships. If two is strong and better than one, imagine three. But the teacher could have continued. And a cord of four, all the more. And if there's five, then, you know, then kind of turns to Dr. Seuss, you'll stay alive or whatever. But I mean, the idea is that more is better because we were made for one another, right? You see, this section shows us our need for one another, but it also points out that relationships and community alone will never be enough. It will never be enough for so many reasons. Yes, a cord of three is not easily broken, but it can still break. And so these verses here highlight two important things. We need one another because we can't provide everything we need in and of ourselves. And secondly, as much as relationships do provide, like everything else, they're not enough. They're good and important, and they are gifts from God. But they were never meant to be everything. And so there's a whole other sermon there. If we are trying to make our relationships everything, we will be let down, just like if we make anything else our everything. But friends, we have not been created to be alone. We've not been created to provide for all of our needs. And think with me here. If these things are true for our physical and temporary needs, how much more for our spiritual and eternal needs? If we need each other for warmth and protection and support, how much more do we need someone for our spiritual need? You see, as we acknowledge our limitations and our needs, as we admit that we can never provide enough for ourselves, but what that does is it prepares us to look to someone else who is able to provide for us before a holy God. And that someone is Jesus. All the kids in the room answered, and I love that. There's no age on that. The answer is always Jesus, usually, eventually, always Jesus. So if I ask a question, and if Jesus doesn't come to your mind, then I failed you as a pastor, because I'm saying that jokingly. We need to look to someone else to provide for us, and that someone is Jesus. Friends, if we have trouble keeping good and healthy relationships with people we love, how can I think that I can make things right before a holy God? The answer is I can't. The answer is you can't. And so God, in His love and His mercy, has made it right with us. Because we're not able, and if we are honest, we're not willing to go to God, because we think we're fine on our own, He came to us. And that's why Jesus came. He did the work that we couldn't do. He paid the debt that we owed. He lifted us from the pit of sin and death, and He showed us what love truly is when He died on the cross in our place. He wasn't jealous of us. He was jealous for us. And He died to make us His own. Friends, The good news of the gospel is that we don't have to strive and try to get what we can out of God. God has freely given us the gift of His Son. If we believe that Jesus has strived and worked and accomplished on our behalf by His life and His death and His resurrection, then we are set free. We are given eternal life and we have been welcomed into the family of God. Put your faith in Him. What else can I say? What else can I encourage you with? If you've not done that, believe that Jesus has done it for you, and finally find the rest that you've been looking for. Let's come to a close as we look to verses 13 through 16. Better is a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer pays attention to warnings. For he came from prison to be king, even though he was born in his kingdom. I saw all the living who move about under the sun follow a second youth who succeeds him. There is no limit to all the people who are born before them, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. So as I study this, and I always begin in the scriptures and consider the text, and I'll use commentaries. I looked at multiple commentaries, and they all say the Hebrew in this section is very difficult to interpret. It's a challenging thing. Now, I'm sure we can get tangled if we try to dig deep into the original language, but the context helps us understand the main point, if you will. Right? The previous verses help us to see how this connects to the theme of wealth, right, and striving and achieving. And also goes back to the idea that we can achieve some incredible things in this world, even royalty, as we see in these verses. But it's not enough because this also ends, like everything else. One king to the next, right? People will follow you for a time until they follow the next person. But what I want to point out is the connection to relationship and a shared life. Look with me to the second part of verse 13, where the teacher writes, an old but foolish king who no longer pays attention to warnings. What I can say about that is that we need each other for the whole of our lives. Even a king who has reigned for an entire lifetime can be rightly referred to and called a fool if he isolates himself and stops listening to the wisdom that comes from others. Well, we can go back to that lazy loner who just folds his arms and consumes himself, right, from verse 5. You see, friends, no matter what status we reach or how we fail, no matter how much wealth we have or, let me check my pockets, don't have, right, our life is lived better together. And that is a gift of God. Friends, life is to be shared. We need each other for all the days that we live under the sun. In the greatest gift that we've been given, Jesus, we have been given another great and undeserved gift, the church. To go from being outcasts and enemies of God and enemies of one another to being welcomed in and adopted as children of the King and part of the family with one another is an incredible thing. It's too much for us to consider. And so I say, let's not forsake the gift that we've been given in the church. Let's not strive to compete with one another or to find gain in this world. Let us, as we're encouraged in the scriptures, to strive to live in unity with one another. To see each other as a gift from God given to us for our time under the sun. And let us find gain in Christ alone. Amen.